This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Hello and welcome to The Feed with Amber Mack
and Michael B. for everything new now and next.
We have you covered for what's happening in the world of tech and what's trending online.
On the show, why Netflix employees are walking out after Dave Chappelle's comedy special, The Closer.
Plus, why one company is betting that the future of healthcare for kids is virtual.
Also on the show, everything you need to know about Trump's free speech app.
And we dive into the ROI of being nice online with Dave Delaney.
That's all coming up right here on The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B.
This episode of The Feed is brought to you by Norton, one of the leading consumer cybersecurity brands. No one can prevent all cybercrime or identity theft, but when you want to help protect your devices, choose Norton 360, available at Staples.
Trending up.
Well, it's another week. Lots of headlines. Amber, Mac, how the devil are you?
I am doing great. No complaints. The time is flying by. I don't know where the month has gone. And with that, Michael, we have another Apple event. I feel like we were just talking about an Apple event. And there is a new one that we want to dive into in terms of a few updates. A redesigned MacBook Pro. That, of course, is their very popular laptop for professionals. And also a new version of their earbuds that has something called spatial audio.
Lots of announcements as usual. It seems to be more upgrades than anything else. Was anything surprising to you, or did you say, finally, I'm so glad they did that?
Well, I will say, you know, I mentioned the MacBook Pro, and I know a lot of very skeptical technology people in my life, and many of them have said over the years that they weren't impressed with Apple computers or laptops, and they thought that they had got deteriorated actually in quality over the years and weren't as powerful as they once were. However, what they have said in turn with this announcement is that a couple of them are going to get this new MacBook Pro, saying again and again the fact that it's powered by these new chips means that it's much faster, much more capable of handling things like heavy video editing is one example. And so I think when we talk about announcements, although this may not be as exciting as a new phone to some people, it appears as though Apple is investing a little bit more in terms of having more powerful machines, especially when it comes to appealing to people in the creative industry.
I think you're absolutely right. And that's what I loved about this announcement. I have a MacBook Pro. I love my MacBook Pro. What I do find, unfortunately, is the battery life. And so finally, there is an upgrade. It's going to get up to about 20, 21 hours, I think it was. And I do a lot of video, a lot of creative work on the laptop, editing, all kinds of stuff. So I'm really excited about that. The price is still a little bit expensive. I mean, you know, MacBook Pro still sets you back a couple of $1,000s. But I mean, the one that I have at the moment, you know, I've had it for 6 or 7 years. If you treat it well, it will stay with you. Now, what isn't being treated well at the moment? This one is a tough one. Lots of controversy around this. I don't know if you've been able to see this yet, Amber, but Netflix employees have walked out over Dave Chappelle's transphobic remarks in his new stand-up special, The Closer. Now, I've seen it. I've watched a lot of Dave Chappelle's comedy previously. I don't even know where to begin with this, because obviously a lot of his comedy is based around trying to educate and show African Americans and the problems that they face, and he does it in a very clever way. That's probably where I'll leave it at that and give you a chance.
Well, I would say if people aren't familiar with the new Netflix special, it is called The Closer, and basically, Dave Chappelle has been accused of making many transphobic remarks in that special. As a result, people supporting the trans community who work at Netflix did stage a walkout this past week. Quite a few people did show up, and I have watched the special, and I would just say, you know, like what many people are saying, you know, the trans community experiences a lot of hate, oftentimes even hate that turns into real physical violence. Is this a community that I think a comedian should go after, knowing, you know, there are many other options of people who probably deserve the intelligent comedy of Dave Chappelle? I would say that, you know, from my perspective, the answer is no. There's also a lot of young people struggling right now. And, you know, he's free to do what he wants. I think, you know, I understand Netflix showing the special on their streaming service. I understand all of those things. But again, after watching the special, I mean, he really, really seems to be pretty intense in terms of joking around about the trans community. And, you know, maybe it was just too much. And again, just like he has a right potentially to be on that platform, if Netflix gives him the go-ahead, the people that walked out also have a right to do so, to protest it. So I certainly understand that. The last thing I'll say on this, Michael, is I think more than anything, I think this speaks to, you know, is Dave Chappelle still, you know, the most relevant comic out there, or does this put him in a category of being kind of irrelevant and not really getting cues about the direction society is going? And that would be something that I think is almost more interesting to debate.
And I will say that those people who haven't seen the special, watch the special first before you comment on it, like anything. And also, he does mention a friend that he had who unfortunately has since died, who was for the transgender community and a comic as well. So I just put it out there for people to watch it themselves and form their own opinion from the content in the actual special itself.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. And we should say that his friend didn't die. She committed suicide. And it was very shortly after she faced a lot of wrath from many people online. So it is a really, really tragic story. And
from her own community, let's just be clear, also from her own transgender community, she received hate.
Yes, absolutely. So I think that, you know, it's an important distinction to make that, you know, sort of a lot of hate all around. And that's my point. It's like when a community is facing so much hate, I mean, do you want to be the person to pile on? Generally speaking, my answer would be no, not really.
No.
So yes, he can do it if he wants to. But again, you know, it puts him in a certainly not the best light. Okay, so we only have 1 minute left, and we wanted to mention that the last story we have is about WorldCoin, cryptocurrency. We only need 30 seconds for this, really, Michael.
Well, so this one I just wanted to say, so obviously I didn't want to get into cryptocurrency, but what is interesting about this is that they've got a device to use that will end up scanning your iris. And so again, this just gets into security and all these kinds of things, and this might be cool and sure, a link to cryptocurrency, look up the story, that's fine. But again, this just like brings up security and devices and how we're quickly willing to do stuff like this and not really focus on it, because I think most people just be like, oh, cryptocurrency, cool. And they'll be like, and why are we getting connected? And can I make a lot of money? And what, they go down that rabbit hole instead of, okay, but someone just scanned your iris and now has it in a database. I was like, that's what I wanted to kind of flag.
Yes, super interesting. And you know what? We should have a cryptocurrency expert on the show, because this is a whole space that is worth diving into, but you really do need someone who spends a lot of time in this space to be able to break down what's happening. Because, I mean, daily there are exciting and interesting and controversial developments, it certainly is something that I don't anticipate is going to go away anytime soon.
No, absolutely not. Well, stay with us. When we return, we teach you about the nice method of communicating online.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. In the spotlight.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Now, it turns out there is actually an ROI on being nice online. Now, I know it sounds crazy, but it's true. We've got the author and speaker Dave Delaney joining us now. He's also the creator of The Nice Method and founder of FutureForth.com.
Very nice to have you here, Dave. Now, let's start with a super easy question. How do you call out incompetence in the workplace in a nice way? And I'm asking for a friend. That's where I'd like to start.
Awkward. Okay.
Let's start from there and move backwards.
Yes. No, it is a great question, actually. And the best way to do it is with empathy and to do it kindly and nicely. And so one way to do that is to have a quiet conversation with that person one-on-one rather than, you know, calling them out. Or, and also I feel in person or these days, you know, at least via Zoom if we must, but if you can do it in person, even better. So I think that helps too, because if you're doing it through like a back channel like Slack or Messenger or something like that, or you're using email, things can get, your sentiment can be misunderstood. And so it's better to talk in person about stuff.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you is that oftentimes in the business world, some people consider being nice as a sign of weakness. What would you say to that?
Yeah, and it's a great point there. But I really do believe that, you know, people get reputations. And actually, I just wrote a blog post about this today, about the point that when you have, if you're like a cutthroat and you're just mean, basically, in the workplace, your reputation will follow. And I just spoke at a conference last 2 weeks ago about the ROI of nice. And I was speaking to a couple people afterwards in the audience, and they said, you know, they talked about this point that they actually named names of old bosses they hated, people that ran the companies that they worked for and the companies themselves. And they had these horror stories that they shared with me just one-on-one. And so that now is in my head. So when I think about those brands and I think about those people, that's what I think about first. So it just pays off. You know, people do business with those they know, like, and trust. We've heard that before. So, you know, if you are hiring, and a lot of people are hiring these days, it's just way better. You're way better off, you know, trying to be a good boss as opposed to a mean, nasty boss.
So this is actually, and I know I usually joke about serious issues all of the time on the show, but this is a serious question, and a serious problem too. So I know a lot of people that are CEOs, and Amber and I have interviewed them, and you're mm-hmm. right. You can come across, and it's very obvious, to be fair, when you spend 5 minutes with somebody, whether they are a very nice person and they have a good, aura of them and the way that they interact with people. And then there are some that you are a little bit prickly and you kind of want to stay away from it, and you can only imagine them in the work environment. But so I guess my question is, what about a leader who is too nice and ends up becoming a doormat, because employees can take advantage of them and walk all over them? So where's the balance? How do you incorporate the nice method and be a good person and create a healthy culture, but at the same time ensure, as I joked off the top of the show, people don't get away with not doing their job and being, you know, all of those other things that we have to deal with as well, because that can be systemic and problematic in culture in the workplace as well.
Absolutely. You know, you can be too nice, and it's important to stand your ground and to also, I mean, being nice doesn't mean that you're being like a saint and you're always smiling and you're always happy and you're doing anything, you know, anything and everything for everyone. Being nice first starts with, you know, and I talk about like three S's of the self, the stakeholders, and society. And so the first S, and you know, is the leader taking care of themselves. So being nice to yourself first and foremost, and that can include things like meditation and mindfulness. It can include things like journaling, which really do. I mean, it works so well. Just taking a beat and taking a minute to yourself, and reflecting on your relationships at the workplace and just your life in general. And so in doing this, it can help you start to think through and slow down enough to realize, whoa, someone's walking all over me and I've got to stand my ground here and take care of this problem. And you can do that in a nice way or not so nice way. So that's up to you.
One question I have for you is how this all changes in the virtual world, because we don't have those face-to-face cues, perhaps, in terms of body language and other signs that a person is being nice. Those are kind of gone for the most part in the virtual world. So how does a nice method work in this way where we are not necessarily going to be face to face?
Yeah, it's I was just reading an article yesterday about how different emojis and emoticons have different meanings in different countries. So you can really insult somebody with one that, you know, completely unaware. So you might want
to
Google that.
I would like everyone to hear that. So Amber, I'm from Australia. Sometimes what I might send you doesn't mean the same thing.
Yeah, it's good to be aware of this stuff. You know, being online, you know, something I've got teenagers now. Gosh, how did that happen? And, you know, something I've been saying to them since they were little is, everything you say, or don't put anything online you don't want your parents or your grandparents to see. And you can replace parents and grandparents, although that's probably the best bet, but you can replace those with, you know, your date or your future boss or your investors or your employees and so on. So, first and foremost, you need to focus on what you're saying online, what you're doing online. We hear these horror stories constantly, especially with politicians and the like, that, you know, they do a search of their old tweets and find all sorts of horrible things. So first and foremost, it's just stop and think before you tweet or before you post that message to somebody and think about, you know, what are the ramifications here? Am I coming across, you know, nicely? Because ultimately, yes, as you said, like, it's so much easier to be nasty to someone online because you don't see them face to face necessarily. So it's all about just treating people the way you want to be treated at the end of the day.
I know it sounds easy, but I mean, when we go online and we see a lot of negative tweets and posts, how do you go about ensuring you are an effective communicator online? Because I know, is it a cultural shift now? It seems that people don't even think that, you know, what I posted on social media matters. And then, as you alluded to, you could walk into the workplace and suddenly it does, or you've been branded not a nice person, or you've said something that someone took offense to.
Yeah, you need to. So it's important to, I keep getting back to this pause point, but it is important. When you read something online, when you see something online, it's important to pause and stop and think, you know, who is this for? Like, what is the purpose of this news headline? Or what is the purpose of this tweet from someone? Like, what is the purpose? Because so often, especially on social networks like Twitter and, you know, that we get, it's the shock factor, right? It's clickbait that's trying to get us angry. It's trying, because when you're angry, you're more likely to engage and you're more likely to share. And, you know, all the, all these horror stories coming out about Facebook and so forth are proof of that. And we already know this. So just question yourself before you start responding and think, you know, am I just feeding this? am I just amplifying this nasty story? And so often, you know, these stories are not related to our day to day. Like, what can we do about this problem? If it's something that's enraging you online, rather than just pontificating on Twitter, you're better off thinking, okay, if this is something like something I really, truly care about, what can I do about it? And I bet you money, it's not going to be posting online. It's going to be calling a politician. It's going to be about maybe joining a cause, something like that instead.
It's a really good point. And I think a lot of people need to remember that action is always the best route. Wanted to remind people they should follow you online if they want to do something nice. You are easy to find on Twitter at Dave Delaney. And we so appreciate you joining us today on the feed.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. And if anyone wants to engage with me, yeah, hit me up on Twitter and I'd love to, or futureforth.com, say hello.
Up next, a new tool to help job hunters make better resumes.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Aptastic.
Welcome back to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. It's time now to take a look at some new and trending apps. And on the heels of doing a segment about the benefits of being nice, I worry a little bit about this new app from former U.S. President Donald Trump, which is all about free speech. And apparently, the app itself will prohibit users from making fun of it. So this is all according to Rolling Stone. So, Michael, what's happening?
So I saw this announcement, and it's actually quoted in here, and I want to read this. So it says, I created Truth Social, which is obviously coming soon. It's in development. It's a social platform specifically for, I'm assuming, people who are like-minded to the former President Donald Trump. And he said, I created Truth Social to stand up against the tyranny of big tech. And then it starts to say all of the things it won't do and what it will do. And it basically seems like he wants a global platform that he can censor to his whim, if that makes sense. So I don't know what kind of platform that is specifically, except for a soapbox, unless I'm wrong.
Well, it's a really good point. I was listening to Pivot with Kara Swisher and Scott Galloway on Friday, and it was interesting because they were talking about this app, and one of the things they said is that, you know, their assumption was that essentially former President Donald Trump really just wanted to have control of a social platform because he had been booted off many others. So this basically gives him a chance to own something and operate something where he gets to decide the rules, because he apparently is still a little bitter about being booted off Twitter. And when you think about it from that perspective, you realize that this social network may be nothing more than a big power play. I think it's fair to say that that would be one of the goals, and trying to build on the audience that he already has of people who are fighting for the ability to say whatever they want. But again, there always has to be sort of limits on that. And I think you'll eventually see that here as well.
Yeah, well, and it's going to be very interesting to see as it rolls out, because obviously we've talked about it on the show, the evolution. So he was canceled from all of the platforms. I think that he realized that that mass reach he didn't have anymore. And I wonder how many of those followers, say, on Twitter were actually people who believed in what he says, or were those people that perpetuated the problem and covered him and discussed him, as opposed to actually believed in what he was saying. And so it'll be interesting to see how that translates over to this platform. Will everybody jump onto this platform just to see what he says, as opposed to follow and believe what he says? And I think that there's another dangerous element there. And I think that there needs to be some kind of accountability, and people need to look at themselves. If you add fuel to the fire, I'm just saying, like, so it's quite a vicious circle.
All right, Michael. So we have another app, and this one is from the New York Times. I just want to let people know that it's still in beta, and it's an app that will help people listen to quality journalism, and it's all about having really excellent audio. So fascinating to see how they're moving beyond even podcasts to think more seriously about storytelling and what can be done in the audio space.
You're absolutely right. And I think that we're seeing this evolution like we did with what we used to call television. And so I think everybody was kind of like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And it went to cable, and then now cable's moving to streaming. I think people forget the actual content hasn't changed, or, you know, it's just now that there's more of it on a different way it's being distributed. And I think that this is fantastic. And what the New York Times audio is trying to do, obviously, is bring everything all into a destination for listeners and create a destination for listeners. And so hopefully this will be a place where we will be able to find credible, you know, high quality podcasts and audio journalism, because I think that's the other problem that we have now in the marketplace. We're saturated by content, and it's getting harder and harder to find those quality avenues to be able to consume the content that we want.
Yeah, it's a really great point. And I'm just excited to see what they do. I believe that audio journalism has such a bright and exciting future. And speaking of exciting futures, we did tease that we were going to make it easy for job seekers to use new tools to get the job that they want. And this one is called Job Word, Michael. So it looks pretty cool in terms of helping people, especially with creating resumes, which can be a real pain.
Yeah, it certainly can. And I don't know if you've ever, when you started out, there wasn't a lot of tools to help you work out exactly what to write, how to present the resumes, and actually go somewhere and get feedback from somebody, you know, is it right? And, you know, how does it compare to those resumes that, you know, end up getting to the top of the pile or, you know, getting a callback or even an interview? So this one is really great. It's a web-based tool and it can help you. It's you can sign up for free. And I love that they've emblazed across the top. This does mean free, because I know whenever we stumble across some really good apps, sometimes there's some in-app purchases and we kind of get down a rabbit hole and then suddenly we're spending a lot of money. And obviously, if you're searching for a job, money probably isn't the first thing you want to be spending. So it's a pretty good one. And I stumbled upon this one. It was recently released in Austin, Texas as part of one of their startup weeks. So it was making headlines there.
It's very cool. And we know more and more people are leaving jobs and there's a lot of disruption in this space. So it does make sense that people do need those tools just to make that whole process better, because it can be quite cumbersome for sure.
It certainly can. Well, of course, if you've got an app, gadget, or product you think we should check out, tweet us at Amber Mac and at AmBancroft80. And of course, use the hashtag TheFeed. Coming up, why kids need virtual healthcare in Canada and beyond.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Techstar.
This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Kix Care connects families and their children with pediatric telehealth services across Canada and aims to enable equitable access to quality care. Elisa Elman is the co-founder and co-founder of Kix Care and is joining us now. This is a really important service, and it's really, we're really happy to be seeing something like this, you know, be offered across Canada. What made you guys decide, you know, this is where you wanted to focus your healthcare services, particularly when it comes to pediatrics?
So thanks for having me here. So Kix Care really came about because of a need that became very, very apparent in the Canadian healthcare system. So the pandemic has really highlighted what's been going on, and access to quality medical care in this country has always been difficult. Patients, families, they don't know where to turn and to get trusted care that is useful for them. So that's really where Kix Care came in. So we wanted to really start chipping away at those barriers and make sure that every Canadian child has access to free quality healthcare.
Now, we should mention that you are a doctor, and so you're coming to this not just from the platform perspective, but also from the healthcare perspective. So walk us through how your experience as a doctor has helped to build this platform and put it in the hands, essentially, of families across the country.
So I'm certainly coming at it from two perspectives. So yes, I am a family physician here in Montreal, but I'm also a mom and I have two little guys, and I know really firsthand that it takes a village. It really does take a village for all aspects of raising a child. And so you taking that aspect of being a mother and the needs inherent to that, as well as the needs of, you know, providers for their patients, it was really a very clear need for what we're doing here. So, you know, in Quebec in particular, accessing healthcare is really quite challenging, and emergency rooms are overloaded, and emergency rooms should be for emergencies at the end of the day. And we're really seeing that these departments are seeing really high numbers of visits that don't necessarily need to be there. So the idea behind Kix Care was really to allow patients to get what they need, to really have their hand held almost through this journey through healthcare, make it feel like a warm hug, so to speak. You know, parents want to feel heard, they want to feel supported. And at the end of the day, they want to get help that they trust. So, you know, whether it was for a new mom who's struggling to breastfeed, a child dealing with concussion or experiencing anxieties, that's really what the KICS Care team works together to ensure that these families get the care that they need.
You mentioned that it takes a village to raise kids. I imagine it also takes a village to create a platform like this. Looking at that online community, how do you onboard and find physicians? And what does that look like? And you know, how has the response been?
So the response has actually been astounding. What is really important to us is to have people who, providers that are aligned with our vision. It's not just about volume. That's really not what we're about. We really care about what we're doing. We want quality care. We want timely care. And we want patients to be able to access it when they need, not 3 weeks later, 3 months later, but when they really need it. So to find these providers, we're really handpicking and you know, looking at our network of colleagues and the people that have joined this platform. Everyone is really aligned in this vision. We actually had a meeting with all of our providers a few weeks ago, and everyone was sharing the experiences that they've had working on the KICS Care platform so far. And, you know, I have to say it was really, we sort of looked around the room and we realized we created something really special. The way that the providers were talking about their experiences, they were describing a level of job satisfaction that, you know, has kind of been missing from the culture these days. It's not just about, you know, like I said, getting people through the door. It's really about making a difference. And, you know, whether that was serving someone who is in a really remote area of Ontario, for instance, or someone who lives in Toronto, but just really has no clue how to navigate the system. And this provider was able to break down those barriers. It's life-changing for a family.
One last question for you in terms of how you see this platform going forward. We know that in the media, there's been many conversations about the importance of getting back into face-to-face meetings with doctors. I was just wondering, to wrap things up, could you talk a little bit about the future of virtual care from the perspective of KICS Care and the role that that can play versus those in-person visits that I think we'd all agree do have to still happen to some extent?
Absolutely. So we're not trying to replace traditional brick and mortar care. Obviously, we need that, and we're meant to be a complement to that and to work together to really enhance all of these services. In terms of, you know, the future of telemedicine in Canada is really in its infancy. Prior to the pandemic, it was sort of a non-existent entity. So we really feel that we're sort of being disruptors in this field and starting to create a culture to move this change forward. And, you know, we're obviously looking to continue to integrate innovative digital health technologies to break down those limitations in telemedicine. So for instance, if we could have a device that the mom or dad has at home in the middle of the night, if their little one is screaming and they think they have an ear infection, they can, you know, put this in the ear and the doctor can see in real time what's going on, and to avoid the need for an emergency room or an in-person visit. So I think the possibilities are endless, and technology is really the way to leverage this and to make telemedicine a super useful tool.
Well, listen, we so thank you for joining us today. We want to encourage people to check out your company. You can go online to kickscare.com. That's KICSCARE.com. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, everything you need to know about the new Facebook.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Power Friend.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. The merry misadventures of Facebook continue with speculation of a rebrand. Joining us now to talk more about this is Alex Heath, who's a senior reporter at The Verge. All right, Alex, break down where we are at today with potentially the new Facebook.
Yeah, so this is a big rebrand that's in the works, not of the Facebook Blue app that people, you know, think of when they think of Facebook, but of the umbrella company that also includes Instagram, WhatsApp, Oculus, their VR division. They just released some smart glasses with Ray-Ban. So basically what's happening is Facebook's ambitions are broadening pretty significantly out of just traditional social media that they essentially invented roughly whatever, 17 years ago now. And this rebrand, which is, you know, a pet project of CEO Mark Zuckerberg, is really meant to position the company as a metaverse company, not a social media company. And so that's what this new rebrand for the corporate identity is going to be about.
So is this something that we could liken to Google, who then came out and had the umbrella company rebrand called Alphabet? So would Facebook then end up being something like Body?
It's a, you know, analogy that you could draw. I think it's going to be a little bit different because when Google did that, the founders retreated from public view, and it was kind of set up in a way that let them kind of distance themselves from the main brand. I don't think that this is necessarily Zuckerberg wanting to distance himself from the main brand that everyone knows of now. And even though you would think that he would want to do that, given all the bad news about Facebook that's going on, I really think this is a mix of like legacy for him, personal legacy, and also just kind of putting a more formal name to the investments they're already making. They have over 10,000 people working on the metaverse. They plan to more than double that over the next few years. They're spending billions and billions of dollars on it. And it's all about owning the next computing platform that comes after laptops and mobile phones. And I do think that that's what they see as the future for the company.
Could you just break down the metaverse? We are familiar with that term, but just for our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with it, I mean, it sounds like a very elaborate thing. And if you have 10,000 people working on it and millions or billions of dollars, even more so. So what exactly is that?
Well, it's kind of funny because the term metaverse was actually coined in a sci-fi novel in the 90s called Snow Crash. And it was meant to describe people fleeing a post-apocalyptic dystopian world to enter a virtual one. You could also, if you've seen the movie Wall-E, you could also imagine like the characters in Wall-E and their floating chairs, you know, overweight with goggles strapped to their face, and they don't even really know where they are, that they're in the spaceship floating out in beautiful space. The metaverse has not been associated with, you know, positive ideas. And I think that's, you know, it's a little bit ironic given like where Facebook is in the world now and how people see the company now that this is the term they're deciding to use. I'm not sure, by the way, I haven't reported the name, and Facebook's keeping the name a closely guarded secret that may not directly nod to the metaverse, but, you know, Meta is a potential name, Horizon is a potential name. It's meant to just kind of signal like, we're all about building this virtual, you know, world that Zuckerberg has called an embodied internet. So I would say that for people listening, probably the closest thing to a metaverse we have today is something like Fortnite or Roblox, where young people are hanging out as, you know, avatars, virtual representations of themselves, playing games, communicating, and just kind of, you know, relaxing in a virtual world. And it's happening on a 2D screen right now, but over the next few years, what's going to happen is there's going to be headsets and AR glasses that make it much more immersive.
Do you think that Facebook is in tune with people and what they want from products online? And I just ask that just because obviously we saw the massive backlash with regards to the suggestion of a children's version of Instagram. And I just wonder, after COVID and everything we've experienced, is a metaverse something that the world needs? Because we can go and see so many movies that show us that it probably might not be the best idea.
That's such a good question, because I think it's very fair to say that Facebook is losing touch with what people want. The product, the main product today, its user base is increasingly older. They're having a hard time attracting young people to the product. Younger people are going more to TikTok and Snapchat and Discord and Roblox. So they're already kind of losing touch with social media as it is today. I do think out of all the companies, in terms of what they've shown publicly, they are ahead in terms of building the hardware and software for the metaverse. I think Apple's also focused on this, but it's a good question. And it's one that I think will take a few years to play out, whether they can build this in a compelling way. I mean, I don't know if you guys have used the latest Oculus Quest VR headset. It's actually pretty good. It's pretty compelling. It's affordable. It's fairly lightweight. The apps are getting very good. And, you know, they're not even at really, you know, a huge market there yet. So I do think this technology is going to become compelling. It's just a matter of whether Facebook is the one to do it and whether people trust the brand to do it as well.
I have had a chance to try out Oculus, and I would agree that it is impressive, and they have definitely improved this technology over the past few years. However, the one thing that really concerns me is that when we think about Facebook and Instagram's experience with a younger generation, we know many of the issues that have come up over the past couple of years. So I worry that when we talk about a whole new universe like the metaverse, that Facebook could go wrong again with our kids.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big concern. I mean, Roblox, which I've mentioned a couple of times now, its audience is even younger than Instagram. I mean, young people are already, I mean, if you could talk to a teenager and they know what the metaverse is, they're like, yeah, I'm in Roblox, so I'm in Fortnite. And yeah, the potential for bullying when it's not just like a comment section, but it's like your virtual representation of yourself. And like you can hear someone's voice as if they are standing right in front of you. You know, I've done a couple of these VR games in Oculus where it's just kind of open world, like anyone can join. And I haven't had great experiences. You know, it's like, you know, people cursing and like just kind of lewd comments. And like, it's just, you have to build moderation and safety guardrails into that. And Facebook does not have a good track record with that, right? So that is also a big bear signal for this, is that Facebook's track record with this stuff is not great. So yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately though, like scrutiny, especially among lawmakers, is super delayed with this stuff. So I have a feeling that by the time all this is mainstream and used by millions and millions of people, we will have just gotten around to legislating Facebook as it exists today. That just seems to be how the law works these days.
Well, it will be interesting to see what comes first, the metaverse or actual legislation. Alex, really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. And obviously, anybody listening, check out all of his great work and the latest work on TheVerge.com. Alex, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stay with us when we come back, the future of robots in war.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Socially Speaking.
It's time now for Socially Speaking. And before we get to our topic of the week, which is all about robot dogs, I wanted to share a cybersecurity tip powered by Norton. Now, October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, so let's talk about getting cyber smart with good cyber hygiene. What exactly is cyber hygiene? Well, you can think about it like a cybersecurity version of washing your hands well with soap for 20 seconds after you come home from a trip to the store. Cyber hygiene is basically a set of habits that can help you and your family's devices stay protected from identity theft, scams, and other online dangers. Good examples of good cyber hygiene are using strong passwords, setting up multi-factor authentication on your accounts, and of course, always updating software on your devices. When it comes to strong passwords, I like to use a passphrase that is unique to me. This is basically a sentence that should be at least 12 characters long. Along with a passphrase, I also use two-factor authentication. That's really a second layer of protection. It adds that extra step between inputting your password and accessing your account. Now, speaking of protection, no one can prevent all cybercrime or identity theft, but Norton 360 is what I trust to protect my devices and my family's devices against cyber threats. For more information, you can visit Staples online or in store. Okay, so guys, this week we are going to talk about robots. This was a story that I saw everywhere, and it's on TechCrunch, and basically, it looks like a robot dog, but it has a weapon attached to the top of it. And this has brought up a whole slew of questions and debates around the future of robots, particularly when it comes to warfare, as one example. So, Michael, I know you stumbled across this, and, you know, it's a frightening image. Like, let's not mince words here. What was your first reaction?
So this frightening is exactly the right word to use, because obviously we've debated on the show before in regards to, let's just say, something like artificial intelligence and the responsibility of using artificial intelligence and ethics. And so when it comes to robotics and then the ethics of using unmanned robots for warfare, what does that look like? And, you know, should that happen? And same thing with using artificial intelligence combined with that. We're getting into a very dangerous area. And I think, like we've discussed again many, many times before, technology seems to progress much faster than what people are able to cope and deal and manage with, if that makes sense. Like, I don't believe people have caught up to the necessary responsibilities of managing where we are with technology. Does that make sense? And so when it comes to this, somebody's gone ahead and made it and stuck, a gun on top of a robot and have it on a website, and I assume eventually they will be sold for that specific use. And I don't know what rules and legislation and all kinds. It just opens up a whole can of worms that we don't have, the right frameworks in place, and that worries me.
So, Aaron, we have seen, of course, the weaponization of machines really for years. I mean, if you think about drones or, even helicopters, it's not brand new. What was your reaction when we start to see this on things like robot dogs?
Yeah, it's shocking at first because, you want to kind of personify, that's not the word, the dog, and think of an actual dog. And then, of course, as I always refer back to, I've been doing on the show for years, refer back to Black Mirror. There was an episode with armed robot dogs, I believe. But at the same time, I'm not surprised, and I don't know if I should be alarmed that I'm not surprised or not. I've seen some some videos of certain militaries in the world that use remote controlled robots. There are some remote controlled robots with a camera on it, sent to knock down a door if a military believes that the door is booby-trapped so a human doesn't do it. So I'm kind of not surprised. But yeah, I agree with Michael that I think the technology is moving faster than our regulations or international treaties will be able to understand, to counter it if it needs to be countered. And that's not to say that if this technology is sold, some bad actor or military or whatever in the field could use it anyways, because there are treaties against certain weapons which have been used, even though there's treaties against them. So I think it's only a matter of time before we see this dog in the field. Someone goes to try to pet it, and then something bad happens.
Well, Amber, I have a question for you. Like, I mean, and is how far away then are we if this then becomes, say, in a member of the police department and starts roaming the streets, or security for building, for private security? Like, it just, if you leap forward enough, I mean, it can be quite scary because, I mean, basically, as we've said, like, they've equipped a custom gun, I think it's Sword International, to robots, and it can go onto most robotic platforms, they're boasting. And this is just too soon, and I just don't think we're ready for it.
Well, when you speak about law enforcement, I believe we actually talked about this, but the New York Police Department was using Spot the robot dog in a pilot project in that city. Now, there was an incredible...
There was no bazooka attached to him, though.
No, there wasn't. But nonetheless, there was still an incredible amount of backlash. Scientific American, I was reading an article a little while ago, says this is really what went wrong and why this was a really bad idea. And they talk about things like design, context, timing. These things are all factors in terms of whether or not humans are willing to embrace this idea of robots taking over jobs. So I will just say that... I don't know if we are necessarily ready for these sort of, I say life-size robots, because I think it does matter that something's walking around on four legs or two legs. I think all of a sudden, it starts to look more like us and the things that we're used to, and that tends to have a bigger reaction. So the public probably isn't ready for it, and yet we're seeing these robots being used in all different scenarios. And you're right, it does make a difference as well if there's a weapon attached to the top of it. So for many years now, people have been trying to figure out how do we basically put parameters around the future of the weaponization of artificial intelligence, and that would include machines and robots like this. I don't think anyone has a perfect answer, but this more and more, I think, makes us realize that we do need more parameters in place, especially from a government level, as far as dealing with this fast future that isn't 20 years down the road. I mean, it's on our doorstep.
Well, I mean, it's here. I mean, I just have to say, the U.S. military, one of the bases in Florida, have actually used and tested out four-legged robots to check and patrol their base's perimeter. So, and they say it's great because it gets to places like navigating swampy areas. But I just, again, imagine if you are patrolling a perimeter of a base, next step would be maybe that person or robot, a four-legged friend that's a robot, also is armed in case, you know, there is an intruder.
Yes. So lots of great scenarios for how robots can be used, and lots of scenarios that are concerning. Of course, let us know on social media what you think of this conversation. Super easy to find us at Amber Mac or at AmBancroft80. And please use the hashtag The Feed.
This is The Feed with Amber Mac and Michael B on SiriusXM Canada Talks, Channel 167.